5 Tampa.
Nobody does it better. Nobody does it better. They can come closer than close. Yeah. Original, they never will be.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo continues a nine-nation tour of the Middle East. He's now in Qatar and is due to visit Saudi Arabia. As NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports, Doha and Riyadh are still in the middle of a diplomatic dispute that Pompeo says is helping Iran.
The U.S. envoy trying to resolve the Saudi-Qatar split has resigned, but Pompeo says the U.S. is still committed to resolving the issue. Gulf unity is key, he says, as he tries to build up an anti-Iran coalition. In Riyadh, he's due to discuss another difficult issue, the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
We will continue to have a conversation with the Crown Prince and the Saudis about ensuring that the accountability is full and complete with respect to the unacceptable murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Pompeo was in Riyadh asking for the same thing last October, soon after Khashoggi was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Doha.
Israel says it's carried out airstrikes in Syria. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem, the target was an Iranian weapons storage facility at the Damascus International Airport.
Syria said the airstrikes took place late Friday night. Israel has publicly admitted to the strikes, which is rare. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel targeted Iranian warehouses with Iranian weapons in the latest of hundreds of recent Israeli attacks on Iranian and Hezbollah militant targets to try to thwart Iran's military buildup in Syria. Netanyahu said, quote, "The accumulation of recent attacks proves that we are determined more than ever to take action against Iran and Syria." The U.S. has backed such Israeli attacks. Also, the Israeli army says it's found the sixth and what it believes to be last tunnel dug by Hezbollah militants to cross into Israel. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In Northern California, dozens of businesses are back up and running after the deadly campfire. But Sonia Husson of member station KQED reports for some, business may be too slow.
People have been moving back into the towns of Paradise and Megalia, which were largely leveled by the fire. They're living in trailers and surviving homes. But so far, it seems like there aren't enough people to support businesses. Locke Cabahome reopened his Paradise Thai restaurant on Friday. He's gotten around 20 customers a day, far below the 120 he usually gets.
We got nowhere to go, so we decided to stay here for a while. Let's see how everybody react to it.
The Paradise Ridge Chamber of Commerce is trying to help these businesses stay afloat. They're maintaining a list of those that have reopened and where, as many have relocated following the fire. For NPR News, I'm Sonia Hudson in Paradise.
This is NPR. The death toll from yesterday's gas explosion at a bakery in Paris has risen to 4. Rescuers found another victim in the rubble today. 9 people remain injured in critical condition. French prosecutors are calling the blast accidental. The Southern African Development Community is calling for a government of national unity in Democratic Republic of Congo. It comes as Congo's presidential runner-up, Martin Fayulu, demands a recount. and says the ruling party has deployed armed soldiers around his headquarters. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports.
This is a highly significant intervention by the DRC's neighbours at a time when the disputed results of the presidential election are still being contested in the courts. The president of Zambia, Edgar Lungu, cited the strong objections to the provisional election results and said he and other regional leaders felt the best way forward was a negotiated political settlement and a government of national unity. SADC's intervention will be welcomed by some as a wise proposal to avoid further bloodshed, but others will see it as another weak and dangerous compromise that undermines African democracy and emboldens autocrats.
The BBC's Andrew Harding. Pro football history is being made today. The first woman officiates an NFL playoff game as the New England Patriots face the Los Angeles Chargers. Sarah Thomas is the only full-time female referee in the league. She's also the first woman to officiate a major college football game. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the School of the New York Times, offering a two-week summer academy for high school students who want to live and learn in New York and Washington, D.C. while studying with Times journalists. Application info at nytedu.com.
Shadows cast by rainbows, there you'll meet the sage. Feeding rabbits bits of lettuce or cleaning out the cage. He can give you more direction than you've ever known. Show you your bright baby shoes now, my how you have grown. Ain't it nice to fly your waving as soft clouds go by, but won't you go exploring? You got to find some truth. You can't spend one more day of Christians shouting down at you. You say you don't dig politics, that never was your bag. People who could run for office wave their private flag. Ain't it nice to fly your waving as all clouds go by, but
The Sunday Forum. So, Lo, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fantastic. Good morning.
All right. And Lo is, we're one deep today, but that's okay. We're gonna make it work. We have a wonderful, wonderful show lined up for you today. I cannot wait to get to it. And we are here on January 13th, 2019. And we have two guests that are going to be here. We have number one, and he's going to be a phone, and in an interview that we recorded yesterday, we have Seth Miller, and Seth Miller is the executive director for Innocence Project Florida, and we'll get into what that is and, you know, and exactly what they do. And then we also are going to hear from Andrew Warren. And Andrew Warren is the Hillsborough County State Attorney, right? So he is responsible for prosecuting all crimes in Hillsborough County, so Tampa, Plant City, Temple Terrace, etc. So, yes, we are going to get into wrongful convictions. And so our theme for today is better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. Better 10 innocent people, 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. And that comes from a quote by Sir William Blackstone. And Sir William Blackstone is a behemoth in the legal field, right? He wrote the Commentaries on the Law of England, and that is really a foundational document or the underpinnings of our legal system. So, you know, very, very heavy hitter in the legal arena. And you know, that saying is really, right on point. So you can call in at 813-239-9663. 813-239-9663. If you have a comment on anything you're going to hear, and again, with the state attorney here, and Seth Miller is already recorded, so we're not going to have any questions for him. But if you have comments or questions on what you hear during the interview, please feel free to call in. Facebook Live, see you guys there. Great to see you as always. Share the page, like the page, tell everyone what we're doing, and you know, spread the word. Spread the word about the Sunday Forum. So we have a couple of announcements I'm going to get to, and we're going to go through a couple of announcements and then just a few current events because we're going to be limited on time, and I want to get through the entire interview and the commentary on the interview before we get to State Attorney Warren. So first announcement, you've been hearing the last couple of weeks, Toba Breakfast, January 21st, 2019, 0645, and there's my military coming out again, 6:45 a.m., Tampa Hilton downtown. We also have the MLK Day of Service at Mount Olive AME Church, 1902 West LaSalle Street, Tampa, Florida, Saturday, January 19th, 2019, from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. You're going to have a lot of presenters and speakers, etc. And then finally, the 6th annual Suit Up and Show Up. It's a leadership retreat for young boys and men ages 16 to 24. That's actually on January the 18th, 2019, 8:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the HCC Ybor City Campus, 2001 North 14th Street, Tampa, Florida. Point of contact is David Jones at 813-231-4362, extension 3020. So those are our announcements for today. Now, first thing, as far as quickly with current events, government shutdown, it's 23rd day. I'm not going to dwell on it, but you know, now it's the longest in history. All right, so you know, to all those folks out there who didn't have a paycheck, I think, you know, over this past week was the first time people got a pay stub with zero. So definitely hearts going out to those folks. And my mother works for the Department of Defense, so I was like, hey, are you good? And she's like, DOD is funded. It's like, okay, phew. So, but there are a lot of folks out there who are not so lucky. Mm-hmm. So, and then, okay. I said before on the show, I can't stand Alabama, okay? I cannot stand the Alabama Crimson Tide, okay? And so I was very, very pleased, with the outcome of the national championship game where they got demolished by Clemson. And at first I'm like, you know, I'm tired of seeing these two teams, right? The last, you know, 3 years straight. But, you know, it was a good outcome this time. And it reminded me of another Alabama game that I love, right? And that is the game between Alabama and Auburn, the Iron Bowl of 2013. Now, the 2013 Iron Bowl, I watched this particular clip we're about to play. I watch that, I would say, once a quarter because I love it. I love it. And as we go through the clip, you'll hear what happened. All you Alabama fans, this was like a knife in the heart. And I love to see the reactions, et cetera. So in honor of Clemson beating down, Alabama, let's play the clip on the Iron Bowl from 2013. Yeah, while we're getting that cue up, here we go.
56-yarder. Does not have the leg. And Chris Davis takes it in the back of the end zone. He'll run it out to the 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 45. There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game. He ran the missed field goal. He ran it back 109 yards. Enough to keep him off the field tonight. Holy cow.
Yo, he's like the best announcer. That's my hype man right there.
Holy cow, they're not going to keep him off the field tonight. Auburn's going to win the football game. Oh, I love it. I love it. So for all you Alabama fans, I just had to serve that up. Just had to serve that up for you. So speaking of football, though, one thing I do want to briefly mention. So Black Monday, we had the firings, right, of various black coaches, leaving a dearth of black coaches in the NFL. And that brings me to the topic of racism and sports. And I want you all to save the date, because February 9th, 2019, Sunday Forum is going to host a panel on racism and sports. Okay, it's going to be racism and sports, $40 million slaves. Right, and $40 million slaves comes from William C. Roden's excellent book of the same title, discussing racism in sports from the high school level all the way up to the professional level. And we want to talk about racism in sports, given what has happened just this past, Monday before, Black Monday, and just what we've seen generally. You had LeBron's comments. You had what's going on with Kaepernick still. You have what was going on with Eric Reed, and just various things. You know, Jerry Jones' comments, Bob McNair's comments about the inmates running the prison. So just a number of issues in the past couple of years. And, you know, we want to get in deep into this particular topic. So we're going to do that February 9th as a fundraiser for the show, because then following we're going to have our regular fundraiser that we have, you know, three times a year. But I wanted to have this panel to discuss this very important issue. So on that note, again, February 9th, save the date. We'll have promos and additional details where we're going to be coming soon, but wanted to at least get that date out there for you guys to save it. And also, while we're here, you know, we've reached out to Miami Dolphins players, particularly Kenny Stills, Albert Wilson, and Robert Quinn, because they knelt during the national anthem or protested during the national anthem. And Kenny Stills has done so for a number of years. So very active and likely to speak out, and Robert Quinn as well. He speaks out quite a bit about racism. So really activist. No, all lives matter, okay? No more of that. But, you know, getting down to the nitty-gritty. So, and then also from the Bucks, Mike Evans and DeSean Jackson, who were also invited, and they were invited through the communications rep for both of the teams. But if anyone has any contacts for any of those players, or for the Miami Dolphins or the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and can help us out, then, you know, please give us a call and let us know. And, you know, and we will, you know, make that happen. I mean, we have already interest from the colleges, HCC and USF, when it comes getting this done. Okay, stop yes. that.
My alumni going to come out showing out. That.
Hampton University. Okay. Okay.
But just to speak on that, Kaya, as far as if they have any connects, but if you, again, social media is powerful, you know, as far as use your emails, use your phone, give these organizations such as the Bucks, such as Miami Dolphins, a call, send them emails, let them know we want our players discussing this. These teams have a social
justice initiative.
So let's push it however we can.
Absolutely. So February 9th, he placed TBD, but, you know, let's make this happen. We are going to have a discussion about racism in sports, you know, very timely, always timely, go through the history, etc. And, you know, with Sunday Forum running the show and Kaya moderating, you know, it's not going to be any tiptoeing through the tulips, okay? No tiptoeing through the tulips. Again, this is WMNF 88.5. You are listening to the Sunday Forum with Kaya Wright and the Fourth Estate, and we are going to be talking today about wrongful convictions, and our theme is better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. Better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. Okay, and just to switch gears just a little bit before we get into the interview from with Seth Miller that we recorded yesterday, Marquise McLaughlin, so I've been giving you guys updates almost every week or whenever there has been an update, frankly, on this case. And I wanted to let you all know, just for informational purposes and for your situational awareness, that a detective in the McLaughlin case was fired. A major detective was fired for coming to a homicide scene drunk. Now, that scene didn't have anything to do with Marquise, right? But it's very relevant that you have a detective in that case who was, in fact, you know, fired, you know, and already the defense counsel are saying, you know, how can you go forward with these charges, et cetera, when, you know, one of your main detectives was, you know, drunk at a scene. Yeah. So whatever, that's their argument to make at trial, you know, as the defense, you know, depending on how involved that detective was. But that is news that we, that, you know, that I wanted you guys to be aware of with regards to that case. So that's what we have as an update with Marquise McLaughlin. So I'm going to switch gears here and talk a bit about the Innocence Project and why I reached out to them to have this interview. So thinking through, as I was prepping this week, thinking through how I wanted to approach the topic and the discussion of the Conviction Review Unit with State Attorney Warren, I thought that it would be good to have a good background for wrongful convictions, right? And the prevalence and just some good nuggets. And the organization that came to mind was the Innocence Project, right? And the Innocence Project is, and I'll let Seth get into that, actually, because I asked him that to explain that. But I did want to let you all know how they got involved and why I decided to go ahead and get this interview done. Because, again, I thought it was very important for you all to know, hey, you know, this is, you know, what wrongful convictions are. Because a lot of people really don't understand wrongful convictions, what the causes of them are, you know, why do they happen given the system that we have. So those are all questions and issues I got into with Seth. And so, you know, I thought it would be great to go ahead and get that going. So what we're going to do is get that queued up and then,
you know. All right. Hey, Seth, how are you doing today?
Okay, so yes, let's make sure we get the time hack. I'm going to skip over all of that, you know, hey, how you doing and all that, and let's get right down to business.
Okay? What exactly is the Innocence Project? What is your mission?
The Innocence Project of Florida is a small nonprofit criminal justice organization based out of Tallahassee, Florida, and our mission is really threefold. It's to find innocent people in Florida's prisons and free them through the use of new evidence of actual innocence, including DNA evidence. Once we are able to prove someone innocent, we want to be able to provide them with holistic services so they can transition well back into a society that oftentimes is extremely different than the one they left many years before. Mm-hmm. And in terms of our reform work, the third prong of our mission, we want to change the Florida's law in order to remove barriers that stand in the way of exonerating people, as well as reform the criminal justice system so that we can prevent future wrongful convictions.
Yeah, so as you can see, you know, a myriad actually of purposes, not just related to getting the exoneration. You know, there's also what happens next. And, you know, so I thought that was something that was, you know, very, very good, because it could just be a matter of, well, hey, we're just going to do this and then we're going to go on and not actually look at, OK, how is it that these people are going to fare once they actually leave? So another question I wanted to know was how extensive wrongful convictions actually were.
A good bit of study on the incidence of wrongful convictions, and some studies have suggested as low as 1-2% of people in prison they're wrongfully convicted, they're innocent, and in fact some studies have suggested it's upward of 6-7%. A study by Pew said that as many as 4% of people who are in death row in this country are innocent. So those are pretty stark numbers, and even if you take a middle-of-the-road 4%, we have 100,000 people in Florida's prisons, roughly. That could be up to 4,000 people who are in prison who are innocent. So it's a huge problem, and there's frankly not enough people trying to tackle it. But at least, you know, we have projects like ours, the Innocence Project of Florida, in most states to really tackle this problem from the defense side to try to find these people and get them out of prison.
So, you know, listening, he talked about the resources, and I focused in on that because you think about, you know, that raises or that begs a question, and that is just how many more people would there be who would be released and who would be exonerated if there were more of these organizations like his, like Innocence Project Florida, out there doing this kind of work. I had seen a study talking about how, you know, certain counties had these organizations and how beneficial it was. And it just made me pause and again think about how many more people would benefit from having this kind of an organization out there. And Seth Miller responded to that question.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's definitely a resource-based issue. It costs money and human energy in order to represent someone, to find them and represent them to get them out of prison. And we often represent our clients for, I mean, years, sometimes 4 or 6 or 8 or even 10 years. And so you need the resources behind that in order to have that kind of consistency to provide that high-quality representation and to see it through to right that miscarriage of justice. So it stands to reason that if you had, instead of, you know, 3 attorneys at a project, if you had 8 attorneys or 10 attorneys at the project and resources to find and screen and find more cases of actual innocence, you'd be able to get them out. So it's really a resource-based issue. And if we were to put more resources to it, I suspect we'd have even more success than we've already had.
And again, we are listening to an interview with Seth Miller. Seth Miller is the executive director of Innocence Project Florida out of Tallahassee, and we are discussing wrongful convictions. Again, this is WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate, and our topic today is better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. So, you know, I thought it was very important to understand the breadth of the problem. Now, another question I had for Seth was about the safeguards that we already have in place, right? So how is it possible that you would actually have, given the system that we have, and it's, you know, it's a great system, at least in theory. We know in operation and application, it has significant problems. But we understand that there are various safeguards in place, right? So I talked about, for example, the Brady Rule, and that's from a 1963 case called Brady versus Maryland. And that particular case requires that the government, the state, that exculpatory evidence or evidence that shows that the individual might not be guilty is turned over to the defense, right? So it's a full disclosure. You can't, as the government, as the prosecution, hide evidence. And the Brady Rule requires that. And a Brady violation is a very serious thing. So with that kind of a safeguard, with the highest standard that there is in court, beyond a reasonable doubt, right? That's what we have for criminal convictions, because you're going to deprive somebody of liberty. So you need to make sure, you know, that you're meeting that very high standard. So I wanted basically to know how it is that with all of these safeguards that we have in place, that we still continue to have so many convictions that are wrongful. And we'll get into a little bit later, you know, the disproportionate numbers of individuals who are of African descent when it comes to this issue, because, you know, there's always going to be an additional item when it comes to us and this particular issue. So the answer to the question from Seth Miller is as
complicated
follows.
To wrongfully convict someone, because we know the things that lead to wrongful conviction. And you had mentioned earlier that we have over 2,300 known exonerations since 1989. And that has given us a data set that has allowed us to look at the things that actually cause wrongful convictions in those cases. We know that the leading cause of wrongful conviction in this country is eyewitness misidentification.
And let me just pause there for a second. So what I had talked about is the fact that since 1989, there had been over 2,000 exonerations when we were kind of going through the resources bit. So that's what he was referring to there.
Not where someone frames someone, but rather where an eyewitness has a good faith basis to believe that the person who they saw is the person who they've identified, but they just are mistaken. But they still come in the courtroom and point to that person and says, that's the person who committed the crime against me. I'll never forget their face. It's seared into my brain. That is incredibly compelling evidence. So you could have the best attorney. You could have a high burden of proof. You could have, you know, the turning over exculpatory evidence. But when it comes down to it, you know, if you have a really great identification that can lead to a wrongful conviction, if it's a misidentification, we know that innocent people confess to crimes that they didn't commit. And we know that because DNA testing has proven that things that look like reliable confessions were actually false and were, you know, erroneous and wrong. And so, when the state presents a confession, that is some of the most compelling evidence that makes a jury find that person guilty. But we know that in about 25% of the cases where folks are later exonerated, they falsely confessed. There's issues with.
So. He talks about the fact that it's not really that difficult to get a wrongful conviction. And, you know, we're going to go through, as he continues, the factors that contribute to a wrongful conviction. And he just talked about, you know, eyewitness testimony. So we're going to get into that a little bit more deeply. And when we get into the second factor, which is going to be, or another factor, which is going to be wrongful confessions, then we're going to talk a bit about the Groveland 4 and the recent pardoning by Governor DeSantis, or as one of my, well, our previous guest, Rosassi, calls him Ron DeRacist. But anyway, Ron DeSantis, then... You know, we'll just talk a little bit about that. But again, this is WMNF 88.5, Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate. And we're going to go to a quick break right after we are done with this clip. It's about that time. And I want to actually, we're going to go through both the eyewitness confession, the eyewitness reliability, the false confessions, and then we'll go to a break. And just on the eyewitness reliability, in one of my criminal law classes, our criminal law professor did this experiment where he had his wife come into the classroom. And this is, you know, right before a class starts, so you're, you know, talking to your friends or whatever. And so it was unusual for her to kind of be in there, so we kind of looked. But then you go on to talking, and then she left, and he wanted us to describe her. And I don't know, there are, I don't know, 100 or so of us in the class, and you had 100 different descriptions of this woman. Okay, you had 100 different descriptions, wrong hair color. I think somebody said the woman was black, you know? I mean, she, you know, she white as snow, you know? I'm like, what is going on here? But, you know, he was making the point that, you know, you just cannot necessarily rely on... on eyewitness testimony. And hey, give us a call at 813-239-9663, 813-239-9663, if you want to comment on anything that you've had here. And again, we don't have our call screener, so you're going to need to tell us your name and where you're calling from. But, you know, I want to hear from you on what we've heard so far. But, you know, it's like you and as he said, people really, you know, rely on that, right? You believe that, mm-hmm. right? It's like, do I believe this slick defense attorney or do I believe my lying eyes? And if somebody's like, well, you know, that's what I saw, it is very, very compelling evidence. But when you do experiments like my professor did and, you know, what the evidence shows based upon what Seth was talking about, then you see that eyewitness testimony is not nearly as reliable as you might think. So I'm going to have him respond to that because I actually stopped him so he can go ahead and talk about that.
Yeah, I think there's a misperception, and it's changing, but I think there's been a longstanding misperception that eyewitness memory or memory in general works like a videotape, that the you view something, it goes in the brain, and then you can just flip a switch and spit back out what you saw. But what we know in reality is that there are things that affect people's ability to take in that memory, store it, and properly talk about it later on. All kinds of factors, both things that are part of the crime or things that happen or things that were environmental factors around the crime that impede someone's ability to provide a reliable identification. I mean, the reality is that people's memories are just not as good as they think they are. And what happens in these cases, and traditionally, is that we've taken a victim's confidence and correlated that with accuracy, when in reality, it's exactly the opposite. That there are all kinds of factors that can, police feedback and the way lineups are composed that can actually inflate an eyewitness confidence. So by the time they get to the trial, they're sure that it's the person when it's not actually the person. That's what all the jury hears. So it can be really compelling evidence, but still some of the most unreliable evidence in a criminal trial.
So, that's really interesting, when you think about that. And you think about the impact that that kind of testimony can actually have on the case. And then the next thing we started to talk about is a question that we all would have when we hear about wrongful confessions. And that is, again, why would somebody confess to a crime that they didn't do?
Right.
I mean, if you told me that I stabbed somebody, yesterday, I would be like, well, it wasn't yesterday. No, I'm just kidding. But you would be surprised. You would be surprised at the factors that are relevant to that particular issue. Again, this is WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate here on WMNF Tampa, and we are discussing wrongful convictions, and our theme is better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. And this is an interview that I did with Seth Miller, who is the executive director for Innocence Project Florida, who pursues exonerations of the wrongfully convicted via DNA evidence.
It's a really good question. And, I go and talk to groups all over the state of Florida, all over the country, and I ask that question, how many of you think that, if put in a certain situation, you would possibly confess to a crime you didn't do? And inevitably, there's people that think they would never do it, but that's kind of what everybody thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that because of, obviously there's overt police coercion and interrogations. There's physical coercion, and those things happen, but we're not even really talking about that. We're talking about the kind of emotional or mental impact of an interrogation that takes a toll on an individual that might make them more likely to admit or cooperate in order to get out of that situation if they think that that kind of stressful situation is going to end. And it's even more acute and exacerbated when the subject of the interrogation is someone in a vulnerable population,
mm-hmm.
A person with intellectual disability, a person who's under the influence of alcohol or drugs or mental illness at the time, a child. All these folks are more prone to false confession because of those vulnerabilities. And what we see is that among the group of people that we know are falsely confessed and are later exonerated, they largely come from those groups of vulnerable people. And so we have to take special care to record the entirety of interrogation so we can root out false confessions before they become part of a criminal trial and contribute to, false convictions.
Yeah, so again, you think, I would never do anything like that. But in fact, there are those factors, that come into play and that affect a person's judgment. So, speaking of wrongful confessions, right? So we have the recent pardon of the Groveland Four, and they had confessions beaten out of them. Okay, so that was, kind of the real kind of old school way, and why there's an unreliability when it comes to torture. Right? That's one of the main arguments against torture. People will say anything to stop the pain from happening, you can't rely on that. We'll talk another time about the torture report and the torture that the United States engaged in. So it's really interesting to think about the impact of a number of factors leading to someone confessing to a crime. And with the Groveland Four, for those of you who do not know, they were accused of rape. There are four individuals, and 70 years later, actually, the victim claims that, yes, it still happened. It was a white woman. And, you know, this was back in the late 40s. And and we understand, you know, what the justice system was. You know, all white juries, it convicted them. Dubious evidence, evidence collection, etc. Actually, two of the individuals were shot by the sheriff subsequently when they were being, quote, transferred. So, but then there's also some evidence. I know you provided that to me, Lo, that one of the family members of one of the individuals who was pardoned was saying that the victim's family knows that she was not telling the truth. And that was a kind of a family secret that she lied, which wasn't uncommon. I mean, look with Carol Bryant, I think was her name at the time, and Emmett Till, you know, exact same kind of situation. So, you know, people do wrongfully confess. And before we go on with this interview here on WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate, where we are talking about wrongful convictions, we're going to go to a break. It's been about 40 minutes, actually about 34 minutes, and you know I like to get a break in, and I'm always a couple of minutes late. But we're going to get it in. We're going to get it in. And as always, when we go to a break on the Sunday Forum, you're going to hear a cut. Right? You're going to hear a great song, Neo Soul Variety. And this is by The Foreign Exchange, which is one of the most slept on groups ever. Okay? One of the most slept on groups ever. And it's a beautiful day outside. And then, you know, I'm going to give you guys a nice cruising song. So this one is Take Off the Blues by The Foreign Exchange. Take Off the Blues.
You're next to me, and when the sun goes down, you're feeling things you never felt before. Nothing left to say to ease your fears, but I know just what to do. Let me take good care of you. And done, and there's nothing left to share. It's the morning after, I watch you lying there. Always told that you should not give in to love, but saying no so hard to do. Cause when the feeling's right, you might as well. Hurt nobody, let me say it again.
will be a big night of rootsy alt-country sounds on January 26th at Skipper's Smokehouse. WMNF presents the second alt-country hoedown with four quality headline bands. Reckless Kelly.
How can you love him if you don't even like him?
Nikki Lane.
Oh.
Dale Watson.
Hey, driver. Hey, he's bound. There's a DOT. He's got his hammer down. He's advertising.
Jason D. Williams.
Oh, Lord, but I'm way too wild. I'm wild. Wild as can be. I'm wild. W-I-L-D. I'm wild. Ooh, yeah. I'm gonna be wild.
The Oak Hill Drifters kick off the wild evening of music at 6 p.m. Saturday, January 26th at Skipper's. Get your tickets now.
Hey,
for more information, go to WMNF.org events.
If either Lucinda Williams or the Drive-By Truckers were coming to town for WMNF, it would be huge. But Lucinda and the Truckers together on February 1st is an unbelievable opportunity to see two MNF standouts in one evening. Lucinda's been a favorite since 1979, when she and WMNF were both getting started.
I'm a story in your car, I won't make the sound.
And listeners have loved the Drive-By Truckers for 20 years, continuing to embrace their recent releases as they become increasingly topical. Lucinda Williams and the Drive-By Truckers, a very special double bill. Friday, February 1st at Janice Live. You can get tickets at WMNF.org.
This time of year, it's out with the cold and in with the new. If you are clearing your garage, WMNF accepts vehicle donations and will gladly worry about the sale and the paperwork, so you don't have to. We will pick up those not-so-cool Hot Wheels at a time convenient for you. Call 1-888-966-3885. Or visit WMNF.org, and thanks. So we have another announcement. We have WMNF has a big concert coming February 1st with two of our favorite bands, Drive-By Truckers and Lucinda Williams. The concert at Janice Live is already selling fast. You can get tickets and information at WMNF.org events. Now back to the Sunday Forum. Your host is Kyra Wright in the Forest Estate. This is WMNF Tampa.
All right, all right. Switching mics there for a minute. All right, all right. Yes, we are back to discuss wrongful convictions. And again, our theme is better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer from Sir William Blackstone. So we're going to continue on with our interview. And again, give us a call at 813-239-9663, 813-239-9663. And we are going over the interview with Seth Miller, the executive director of Innocence Project Florida out of Tallahassee. And he was going over some of the factors that contribute to wrongful convictions. And this particular item, so he talked about eyewitness testimony, talked about false confession. And then the other item, because in preparation for the interviews, both his interview and for State Attorney Warren, I was looking up the factors that contribute to wrongful conviction. And Innocence Project Florida and Innocence Project, you know, writ large, had forensic science misapplication. So this is what Seth is talking about in this next clip.
A mainstay in criminal investigations and prosecutions. And what we have found is that outside of DNA, there's major problems of scientific validity with most of the forensic sciences, most of the forensic methods that are used to connect individuals to crimes.
Hmm.
And the National Academy of Sciences, which is a leading government-funded, august body of scientists, came out with a study in 2009 on forensic sciences and found that basically most forensic science methods lack scientific validity, or at least they haven't had robust enough study and you know, for validation to demonstrate that scientific foundation. So it's a huge problem. What we have seen in the course of our experience is that in many of the cases that have eventually led to exoneration, things that we thought were you know, really solid forensic sciences, and to a jury seem, you know, really powerful, right? You have a somebody from the FBI or somebody from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, these preeminent law enforcement agencies coming in and saying, look, I do this test that you don't understand, mm-hmm. and it matches the person who's sitting at the defense table. And that is, again, some of the most compelling evidence. And it's hard to counter that. We've now only come to realize through DNA testing that so many of those forensic science methods were just wrong or junk.
Wow. So, again, forensic science. And then what I talked about after that is the fact that, you know, jurors don't know any differently, right? They don't know, you know, how, you know, whether or not to believe. I mean, they don't have the detailed scientific knowledge, obviously, and they are going to be relying on the law enforcement agencies, you know, like he talked about the FBI sitting there doing what they do, and you're just going to trust that. I mean, it's just natural to do so, especially given the fact that you don't understand it, and you're not expected to, obviously. And then you have the battle of the experts, right? And so there's one expert from one side saying A, an expert from the other side saying B, and then it comes to, you know, they're just going to be confused. So we address that next.
Totally right. And, you know, our jurors are just people from our community,
right.
and most people who sit on the jury don't have scientific or technical backgrounds, and so they depend on the lawyers to question the witnesses properly in order to try to figure out how to understand that evidence. And when it's super technical, incredibly, based in science, it's hard for the layperson to understand. If you have a defense attorney who doesn't properly and vigorously adversarially test that evidence, then it's almost certainly going to contribute to a person's conviction if it's an innocent person and they're going to be wrongfully convicted.
Yeah. So very, very important there. And as he mentioned, evidence that is extremely, extremely compelling. And another factor that we talked about, and I'm going to expound on it a little bit later in the clip, or I'm going to expound upon it here as well. But we also talked about official misconduct. And even though it may not be the top factor when it comes to wrongful convictions, I would say it is the most sinister, the most disappointing, and a complete travesty, because what you have are people in positions of trust, abusing that trust, okay? Abusing their positions for what? To get a conviction. And totally inappropriate. So we're gonna hear from Seth about that.
We've seen all over the country, all kinds of police misconduct in terms of treatment of subjects during interrogations. We've seen police and even prosecutors hide evidence. We talked about the Brady Rule, which is a constitutional due process requirement to hand over favorable evidence to the defense before trial. But if that disclosure doesn't happen, then a trial gets tainted.
Mm-hmm.
And it still means you have to then find that evidence. So it can go years, even decades, before that evidence that should have been turned over pre-trial is found. And then, of course, you get a proceeding where you could prove that, you know, it was material to your case, but you could be two decades down the line. So it's really incumbent upon prosecutors to make sure that they're faithful to the Brady obligation and always err on the side of disclosure.
Absolutely.
So they can prevent wrongful convictions.
All right. So talking about misconduct, so then I brought up a couple of instances, right? So one of the most recent and most infamous is Baltimore. Not only did they have two police officers, and there's a big whole sting of them, convicted of actual robbery, okay? Basically, their reasoning was, well, who are these people going to go to? You know, we're the cops. And then you also had the framing of black people for drug crimes, right? So you had other Baltimore police officers engaged in that misconduct, and the prosecutor having to go back and look at cases involving those police officers to see whether or not those particular cases will be able to stand. And of course, here in Florida, in Miami, we had, you know, the police chief, you know, Raimundo Atesiano, who was framing black men in particular, okay? Black men in particular, with regards to random crimes. And, okay, you know, I got it that you have an obligation, but in an obligation to, you know, try to fight crime to your best ability, but you have a higher obligation, I mean, this should go without question, of doing so in an appropriate manner and not doing so in a manner whereby you are framing, I mean, this is so absurd even to say this, but you are framing innocent people. And as I've spoken about before, you framed innocent black people in particular. And you did that for a reason. Again, this is WMNF 88.5 with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate. And you are listening to the Sunday Forum, where we are talking about wrongful convictions. And our theme is better 10 guilty persons go free than one innocent person suffer. And again, this is WMNF 88.5, WMNF Tampa. And I see we have a caller on the line, so I'm going to go ahead and get to that caller before we get into some more detail about examples of official misconduct. Caller, you are on the Sunday Forum with Kaya Wright in the Fourth Estate, and because you're going to be your own screener this time, if you can tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hey, good morning. I'm Peter from Plant City. I think you've got a phenomenal topic that'll never be talked about on Bay News 9. But I think that your guest, I think it's fair to say, and until attorneys start saying it, good attorneys start saying it, you get an attorney means guilty people can get off. Having a poor attorney or a public defender means innocent people go to jail all the time. And the bottom line is, the black community gets hurt hard, the Spanish community gets hurt hard, and the poor whites get hurt hard, because who are the police going to frame up? The guys who can't afford an attorney. And that's how the whole prison industrial complex flourishes. And tell me one thing that I said that is a lie.
Well, let me just respond to a couple of things. First of all, there are a lot of great public defenders out there who do an excellent job. And but it is true, the larger point of a lot of times having a certain level of competence or having money assist you in ways that not having money does not. Okay, so I agree with that point, but not just the fact that you have a public defender, because there's some really good public defenders out there. And then the second bit, and now hold on, let me, no. My Peter, what I do is I generally try to let guests go ahead and get their point out. Sometimes I interject something funny, but I let you get your point out, and then I'm going to say my piece, and I'll usually let you respond, okay? And so, and then the next bit, as far as who is hardest hit, the people hardest hit, the people getting framed for crimes, the people getting killed, et cetera, are black people. Okay, so it's not equal across the board. Oh, there's some poor whites. Oh, yes, there are poor whites who get hit. Yes, there are Hispanics who get hit, but black people, and we'll get into the stats later, get hit the hardest. So the fact of the matter is, it is important for prosecutors to focus their attention on ensuring they have the right people. And when we get to State Attorney Warren, I have a question focusing on that bit, because we need to do preventative stuff and not just things after the fact with Innocence Project Florida, okay? So, or Innocence Project wherever we are. All right, so that's my response to what it is you had to say. Agree with some caveats.
I'll just agree. I'll give you a great example. My son is white in a car with two black boys. They get caught with marijuana. I get a lawyer that costs $1,500. He walks, no record, nothing, same exact case. The other two go to public defenders, and they are in the barrel of hell right now because of the public. And why is it that I get a lawyer? They're all three as guilty as same. I get my son the lawyer. He walks totally free, dropped. But the two kids that got public defenders because their parents didn't have any money are now in the system from hell.
Yeah. So
when you tell me the prosecutors or the public defenders do a good job, I understand they got a great heart, but I also understand they're not going to fight like a lawyer who's getting paid $1,500. I mean, just the way the system works. And until it gets addressed and public defenders get paid more and their caseloads get less and there's incentives for them to actually defend their clients, you're the black, the poor, the Latins are going to go to jail.
Okay, so thank you very much for your call. Appreciate you, Peter. And in response, I would say this. Simply because you pay a lawyer a lot of money, that doesn't mean that individual is good. And simply because somebody's a public defender doesn't mean the public defender is bad. Okay? So in your particular case, you know, whatever happened, though in that particular case, that those public defenders didn't do their job or whatever. Okay, so that's about those two public defenders. That's not about public defenders as a whole. And I'm saying this as one of the most